Welcome to the Science Podcast for April 19th, 2013. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. Today's show is all about this week's special issue on grand challenges in science education, including improving the university system, physical versus virtual lab spaces, and science education for non-scientists.
We don't spend, I would say, nearly enough time teaching kids how to connect science with their daily experience.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
Career scientists build their work upon the foundations they learned in science classes earlier in life. But what about those who don't pursue careers as scientists? Is that same basic information valuable to them? How do they interact with science later in life? Noah Feinstein spoke with me about his paper on reimagining science education for non-scientists.
Science changes so fast, and the sorts of things that we want from science change so fast that it's impossible to predict what science is going to matter to the public in 20 or 30 years. What we try to do right now, and what science education has tried to do for a long time, is to give students a sort of minimal, complete set of scientific facts and principles. And instead of doing that, we should be thinking about how those same students are going to need to improvise when they're adults and when they encounter things that you or I could never have anticipated. Making the connection between science and real life or daily life is not just a way to teach the same old science content. It's actually one of the most important skills that our students can develop. So they're going to need to be able to make those connections on their own when the teacher isn't there to help them. We don't spend, I would say, nearly enough time teaching kids how to connect science with their daily experience. We focus on artificially simple problems and assume that students will somehow be able to see how those problems relate to the far more complicated reality of their lives. The question is, what will make them good at making sense of the science that matters to them then?
So what are some examples of how non-scientists may encounter science and need to deal with it in their daily lives?
So probably the two most common scenarios involve personal health and politics, things that seem really different on the surface. If you have a child that's been diagnosed with a rare disorder, and you have to make a decision about what kind of therapy to seek, that's a very personally important decision, and it's time-sensitive. That's the kind of thing which I think is absolutely common. We used to have the problem that people couldn't access scientific information, and with the amazing transformations in information technology, that problem has gotten a lot less important, but the problem of making sense of that information is much more important. So on the politics side of things, the most obvious example, and the one that I know that we think about and talk about a lot, is climate change. Americans hear all the time that the science behind anthropogenic climate change is still hugely uncertain. And the readership of this journal knows that that's not an accurate representation. There are really a vanishingly small number of dissenters. But how is a member of the public supposed to understand what scientists do and don't know, and what constitutes real, meaningful uncertainty in scientific work?
And then there's the fact that we tend to categorize people as scientists and non-scientists,
right,
or scientists and other. What's
right.
The problem with that?
Right. Non-scientist is a category that really only makes sense to scientists. It's sort of an everybody else category. The reality is that everybody's a non-scientist. Even scientists are non-scientists most of the time when they're not at their labs. And there are so many different groups of people who respond to science differently because of the demographic group they belong to, because of their earlier exposure to science, because of their particular personal and cultural values. So the example that we use in the paper is that every time there's an important political election, we take it for granted that different groups of people are going to respond differently to political events. But we don't always understand that people respond differently to science as well.
Now, you mentioned some alternative pedagogies that may help students to better interpret and evaluate the science that they may come across later in life. So tell me about those.
So one cool thing which a group of education researchers has done in the past 5 years is engage students in science journalism through a project called SciJourn, which employs a professional science journalist as an editor and has students not only investigating scientific topics that they find interesting, but also thinking about how they would have to explain those scientific topics to other people who might have different interests in them. And that's, for me, a really fascinating way of getting at how science might be relevant to a wide range of people and helping students learn to understand, for instance, which scientific sources are more viable and trustworthy. Another one that's attracting a lot of attention these days is called problem-based learning. And that starts with a troubling question, the question that's not neatly defined in scientific terms or in disciplinary terms. And students have to work, usually in a team, to look for new information and develop an answer to that messy question or a solution to that problem that integrates what they've already learned in their class, possibly with other things that they've had to seek out on their own. And that's the kind of pedagogy which has proven enormously effective in medical schools. It's been adapted for K-12 settings, particularly in gifted education, but I think it has a really wide range of applications that we could take advantage of to help students learn to cross back and forth between the world of their daily experience and the world of science.
And this all dovetails quite nicely into one of your other priorities, which is cultivating appreciation for science.
Absolutely. One of the things which, and this really gets me, we don't really make room for students in our K-12 system, especially, to develop the sort of deep, weird, personal interests in topics that relate to science. And that matters because research is beginning to show that kids and people more generally who have that kind of personal investment in a science-related topic, maybe a topic that is not important to the curriculum as we think of it now, that those people have a different kind of a motivation and confidence in learning and approaching science in the future.
And what are some ways in which we can develop and cultivate that kind of interest in young students?
There's so many things that are going on right now in the world of public engagement with science. This is a case where the world is really way ahead of what formal education does. There are things like makerspaces, which are attracting a lot of attention. And engineering is not the same as science, and tinkering around in a makerspace is not necessarily going to lead you to science. But that kind of deep technical involvement in building things and figuring out how they work can provide a lot of opportunities to think and learn about science later on. There are also an increasing number of technological platforms for kids to learn about science, like Foldit or Galaxy Zoo, these games which scientists have come up with, which enable people who are not scientists themselves to actually participate in the scientific process. Finding space to get that kind of project into schools is, I think, a high priority, and I think it's something that would make science education more fun.
So what can scientists do in all of this? Is there a role that they can play in arming non-scientists with the skills that they may need?
Scientists may not know this, but they're actually quite influential in science education, both in schools and out. And there are some more general things that I think that scientists can do, and there are also some more specific ones. The most general thing is to be willing to question the way that we've always done things and to bring the same skepticism to our assumptions about science education that scientists professionally bring to their own work. We have to be willing to change the balance and to let go of some of the stuff that we've always done in order to come up with a science education that is really going to be useful for future citizens. And here's something which is much more specific. Don't hide how science really works. So this gets back to that point about peer review. When scientists write and talk about science, they don't necessarily talk about the human side of it, about how frustrating it can be, how long it can take, how careful you need to be to make sure that everything is as right as it can be, and how likely it is that that's going to turn out to be wrong next year or not quite the right solution. Have you seen perhaps the Twitter phenomena, overly honest methods?
I have. I took part in that as well.
You did?
Yeah.
I think it's fantastic because what it reveals is that science is work that's done by human beings. It doesn't just emphasize their fallibility. It also shows that they work very hard and they go through time-honed processes that try to take this mess of information and data and turn it into a finding that people can rely on in their lives.
Noah Feinstein, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Noah Feinstein and colleagues write about science education for non-scientists in a review as part of this week's special issue on grand challenges in science education. Hey, podcast listeners, this week's show is sponsored by Audible. And there is a special deal being offered to our listeners. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/sciencebag, you can get a free audiobook of your choice.
And as usual, this week, we're offering some ideas for your free download. This week, I picked something to go with the educational theme. An audio science book for kids called Giants of Science. This one features Leonardo da Vinci. Okay, what about you, Carrie?
Well, Sarah, for anyone looking to learn about evolution, genetics, natural selection, things like that, I would highly recommend The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins, if you're one of the few who hasn't read it yet.
Okay, well, I hope you get a chance to check out these books and more from Audible. And don't forget, you can get a free download just for signing up at audiblepodcast.com/sciencebag. In the United States, college-level science is typically taught by researchers, scientists that spend the majority of their time pursuing research goals and finding funding. More money means more research, and that means points on the board for profs trying to score tenure. This point system for advancement has set up a structural problem for universities and students in which the best researchers advance in their careers, but the best teachers don't get the same level of professional recognition, leaving students with an educational setting that wasn't designed with education in mind. I spoke with Jeffrey Mervis about one person who's trying to rework this system.
One of the issues is that schools of education are generally not connected to colleges of arts and sciences. In other words, the people who teach teachers aren't usually the same people that teach undergraduates who are majoring in science. And so what goes on in the research community stays within that community, unfortunately. Another factor is that for most faculty members, they've done just fine. The reason they are where they are may be despite poor teaching at the undergraduate level. But nevertheless, they've managed to do fine. And for a lot of faculty, they don't see any reason to do anything different.
Your piece focuses on Carl Wieman. How did he get involved in this?
Well, Carl Wieman is a physicist who won a Nobel Prize in 2001 for his research on low-temperature physics. By then, he had already begun to be interested in undergraduate teaching and learning, in part because he noticed that his students, even though he would give what he considered brilliant lectures, didn't necessarily learn the material that they were supposed to. On the other hand, his graduate students, once they had spent a couple of years in his lab, seemed to perform very well. Mm-hmm. And since he was the constant in that experiment, he began to think about why was it that the kind of approach he was taking was not effective in the lecture hall and why it was effective in his lab. And the answer, he realized after going through the literature, the answer was that active student-centered learning, the kind of hands-on instruction, one-to-one guidance, mentoring, correcting mistakes, listening to the student who had misconceptions, correcting those misconceptions, was the way people learned, and not just students in his class, but that's how all of us learn best.
So lectures were not working, but being in the lab, interacting one-on-one or in small groups was the way to go.
Right, so that was more effective. Unfortunately, it's impossible to do that with 500 students in an intro physics or chemistry or biology class.
But he has developed some ways of kind of getting this practice in place. Can you describe what these reforms look like in the classroom?
Right. So what he's done is he's built on the extensive literature on student-based active learning and combined it with something that he calls deliberate practice. And that's based on the idea that the brain is a muscle that needs to be exercised, that needs to be trained. You need to have someone who gives you incentives, who corrects your mistakes, and who helps you do something over and over and over again until you get it right.
So how does that happen in the classroom, in the classroom setting?
So it's interesting. The way they do it in the classroom relies heavily on graduate students and postdocs who are called science teaching and learning fellows. And they work initially with faculty members to sort of break down what it is they want students to learn from the course. And you can break that down into what they call learning objectives, and then you can write questions that explore whether students understand those concepts. And that involves another technology that's been developed. People refer to it as clicker questions, in which the faculty member poses a question at the beginning of the course. Students meet in small groups. It's a multiple choice answer. And the answers are designed to ferret out common misconceptions. And so once students agree what the answer is, if they're wrong, then the faculty member corrects that. They discuss why it is that they think that rather than the correct concept. They talk about how that concept is connected to the learning objective, and then they move on. So the course becomes a series of responses and discussions around specific questions and concepts rather than a broad lecture on a topic.
So what kinds of results has he been able to produce under this new teaching regime?
Well, the results have been remarkable, although they haven't been able to do the kind of long-term controlled experiments that they would like. But they're the kind of results that, according to the dean at University of British Columbia, where Carl has been for the last several years, just caused faculty members to drop their jaws and say, oh my goodness, I never realized that students could actually learn the material so well. Maybe I should think about changing how I'm teaching.
Well, so this sounds great, and it also sounds kind of like a lot of work for professors and to bring in other people to help with the classes. How can we convince people to do this?
The first question is it a lot of work? His answer is, it's not a lot of work, and I can talk about that if you want. It isn't as much work as you might imagine, but it does require a commitment to improving. And most faculty members want their students to learn. And so they have an incentive to teach in ways that are going to improve what their students learn. The problem is they don't want to do that at the cost of other things that they do, most importantly, research. And so this has to be balanced. What the folks at the University of Colorado, where Carl was before he went to UBC, and at UBC have demonstrated is that the two can go together. But you need support from the highest levels at the university. And in particular, you need buy-in from the department.
Mm-hmm.
The department is the key unit of change at a university. The department sets the rewards, it hires, it promotes, it awards tenure. If a department is resistant, then I think Carl has found that there's very little you can do as an individual. And even if you do, it probably can't be sustained.
Right. So he also tried to make some of these changes at a more systemic level when he was had his position at the White House. Can you talk about that?
Right. Well, he came to the Office of Science and Technology Policy to be Associate Director for Science, but what really attracted him was the opportunity to improve undergraduate science education. And what he proposed was to link federal funding for research at universities to teaching practices, specifically that universities be required to collect and disseminate information on their teaching practices in order to remain eligible for federal funding. This was a radical idea, and not surprisingly, most university presidents and administrators, and even most of his colleagues across the government, felt that it was going too far. Carl feels that it's necessary and essential that this information be made public, and that once it is public, students will use it to select where they want to attend college. The argument that the university administrators gave is that it was, in effect, another government mandate. It was an unfunded mandate. It would be difficult to collect information on these practices. You could game the system because you were collecting it yourself, and it wouldn't achieve what you wanted to achieve. And so there is a voluntary program going on that's sponsored by the Association of American Universities, which is a group of leading research universities that hopes to create a voluntary framework for improving undergraduate science education and then give universities the opportunity to implement it at their own pace under their own conditions.
So they can talk themselves up and they can say that they're doing it when they are, but there's no penalty for not doing it at this point.
Well, I think the feeling is that if you're committed to it, you don't need the stick because you want to do it.
Yeah.
I think what Carl and others is worried about is that even if you want to, you may also need a little bit of encouragement.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Jeff Mervis, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Mervis is a staff news writer for Science. His news focus on Carl Wieman's efforts to overhaul undergraduate education is part of this week's special issue on grand challenges in science education.
For many of us, that first lab experiment in school was a disaster. Maybe you didn't measure fluids at eye level, or you dropped a flask, or you lost track of time and never even finished. It can be difficult to learn key ideas and lab practices at the same time, which is one reason why Ton DeYoung and colleagues propose classroom learning that combines physical with virtual laboratory experiences. He spoke with me about the benefits of these contrasting learning environments.
What we intend with the paper is to highlight the affordances that different types of laboratories, and more specifically physical and virtual laboratories, offer for learning, what they offer for students. And what we do in the paper is that we summarize these affordances together with a selection of the research that compares the effects of learning with these different types of laboratories, the physical and the virtual ones. And the conclusion that we get to is that if students want to acquire conceptual knowledge, we see that in the far majority of the cases where we see research, those virtual laboratories perform at least as good or better than in physical laboratories. But we also see that physical laboratories has some specific advantages, such as letting students experience the presence of measurement errors. So in the end, what we are seeking for is a kind of combination of the two laboratories to optimize learning.
Okay, so first off, what exactly is a virtual lab? What does it look like and how does one interact with it?
Well, if we have a general definition of a laboratory, you could say that that's a room or a building with special equipment for doing scientific experiments and tests. And what you do in a virtual laboratory is that you virtualize that room and that equipment. So you do create it in software. And often what you try to do is to mimic the real laboratory in its appearance, but that's not always necessary. You can make simplifications and leave things out to make it more manageable for the students. And if you see how students operate such a virtual laboratory, they do that through the computer interface, in which quite often direct manipulations is offered. Of course, we can see still differences between the real and the virtual laboratory, despite the fact that they might look the same. For example, in a real optics laboratory, students have to change physical lenses if they want to change properties of a specific lens. In a virtual laboratory, they can simply and directly change the properties of a specific lens in a setup without having to replace that lens.
And how common are virtual labs right now? How are they used currently?
Well, it's not easy to say. In the current project, we are doing an inventory under teachers to see how often and what kind of labs they are using. So I don't have a real complete overview of the real usage. But there are a number of very popular websites with virtual labs, such as Fizlets, and they are used worldwide. And there are also many local initiatives. So many organizations make their own virtual laboratories. So I think many teachers use them. But I don't think it happens at a large and an organized scale. And I don't know the case in the U.S., but in Europe and in the Netherlands specifically, teachers rely on methods that they get from publishers. And if they take a virtual lab, for example, from the web, and they have to adapt that to the method that they use from the publisher, that is quite some additional work for them to do. I was at a fair yesterday where many publishers were, and they all are seeking now for interactive material. So I would guess that in the near future, many publishers will get into this area and really start to make simulations and virtual laboratories.
So as you pointed out, there are some distinct differences between physical and virtual labs. In physical labs, you get to actually experience setting up the equipment. It's a tangible, tactile experience. Can virtual labs offer that same sort of valuable insight?
Well, as I said before, if you look at the research, we see that if we look at conceptual knowledge, virtual laboratories really offer at least the same opportunities as physical laboratories do. But of course, by nature, they cannot offer the tactile experiences that the physical laboratories do. So in that respect, there's a real advantage for the real labs. There is a whole area in psychology which is called embodied cognition that says that students really need to feel objects to really get knowledge. From the research, we don't see that students need those real tactile experiences to gain understanding. Maybe there is an exception here for very young kindergarten children who have no experience in the domain. My colleague Zacharia, who's a co-author, did an experiment with a balance beam with kindergarten kids and found that a physical laboratory had some advantages for that age because they had no experience with balance beams before. The virtual lab, on the other hand, also offers quite interesting new developments in this haptic area. I recently read a report about a virtual experiment in which a haptic component was added to a simulation such that students could feel interactions between molecules as forces. So they could feel how the molecules interacted, which, of course, you can never feel. And these researchers found that it really added to the learning of the students. So the haptic experience could also be made virtual and even add haptic experience that we cannot experience in real life.
And so, of course, the advantages of these two different lab environments and the trade-offs between the two is why you propose using a combination of both approaches in the classroom.
Yes, indeed. In the end, you see that both types of laboratories have their specific affordances. One thing that is really important in both cases is that students receive good guidance. If we just give a lab to a student, a simulation to a student, we see that it doesn't result in learning. They have to be supported in the inquiry process. Mm-hmm. But what you do see is that if you combine the two, that you can have the best of both worlds. So, for example, in a physical laboratory, you can have students experience measurement errors, which, of course, you could simulate in a virtual laboratory, but it's like you cheat, like you don't feel that as being a real measurement error. So if we can make a smart combination between the two, it really has advantages. Recently, I did a study with one of my colleagues for students in vocational education, and we gave them, in addition to the curriculum, a virtual laboratory, and they also had a physical laboratory. And we found that adding that virtual laboratory really helped the students to gain the more complex kind of knowledge. But still, they need it, especially these kind of students who go into practice. They really need the practical laboratory, the physical laboratory, to really go into the real equipment that they have to work with. I'm now leading a large European-sponsored project that's sponsored by the European Commission, where we also work with remote laboratories. And remote laboratories are a kind of in-between. It's a real laboratory that you can manipulate on a distance. And one thing that is really exciting, if we succeed in making, for example, virtual overlays of the real physical environment and students see that physical remote lab through a webcam, then we really have a real integrated combination of the two.
And another interesting advantage that you bring up in your paper is that reducing physical lab time and complementing it with virtual lab time is cheaper. It brings down costs.
Well, what we do see is that the budget of many schools is under pressure, so they really have to find ways to do things cheaper. Of course, creating a virtual lab costs money and time, but often that is done by larger organizations or by sponsored projects, or as I can now see that publishers will take that up. And if schools have that available, of course, they don't have to maintain so many physical laboratories, which take more space and more time. And, of course, they don't need to maintain the equipment there. And if there's new equipment, you can really introduce that in a virtual environment more quickly than in a real environment.
So what are some of the challenges, then, to bringing this combination approach to fruition in schools?
There are really some challenges there. Of course, if you have the both versions in the classroom, you really need to tune the two so that they are presenting students with partially overlapping but not completely overlapping information. And we don't know exactly what is best at the moment. We also don't know if it's really better to show them concurrently. So do you work in a real laboratory with a virtual laboratory next to you? Or do you sequence them? And then in what order to sequence them? There are indications to say, and I would only say indications, that it's better to start with a virtual laboratory and then take your insights to the physical laboratory. But maybe there are also domains or type of students where the sequence needs to be in a different order. So we really have to do more research to find out what is the real good combination concurrently or in what sequence for different domains for different types of students. So there's a challenge to find it out.
Tan DeYoung, thank you so much.
And thank you so much. It was really a pleasure to do this.
Tan DeYoung and colleagues write about physical and virtual laboratories in a review in this week's special issue on the grand challenges in science education. You can find all the related news, reviews, perspectives, and a video at www.sciencemag.org/special/education2013.
And that concludes the April 19th, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.